I'm Christopher Lydon with an open source invitation. The astonishing cabaret singer and heartthrob Amanda Palmer and I are hanging out in Harvard Square on the Monday night after Thanksgiving, talking songs and life, and maybe she'll sing her song about me. And of course, we want you to be there. Monday the 27th at 7 p.m. at the First Parish Church in Cambridge. Go to radioopensource.org for details and tickets. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The double shadow on our great American food holiday is feast and famine, both. A bounteous industrial food system is wasting the land and leaving a billion of us humans hungry, and another billion both stuffed and undernourished. As climate change kicks in, the food agenda is changing too. Farm-to-table greens, slow food, local food don't sound like answers anymore to the depletion of farm soil, the making of new deserts, runoff pollution, the vast scale of food's maldistribution. Who's going to be ready by mid-century to give up steaks and chops, even chicken, for the good of a plant-based diet? And speaking of food, bite into one of those big red year-round strawberries and explain, whatever happened to the best part of our food, which used to be flavor? The food of the future is going to be different under the pressures of climate, migration, politics, and not least from the digital revolution. Consider this. They are growing basil in computers at MIT this fall, tweaking flavors inside those bright green leaves that make pesto. Walk into the Open Agriculture Initiative as we did this week, and here's the sort of food chatter you fall into.
So the Open Agriculture Initiative is the name of the lab, and we call it Open Ag for short. Mm-hmm. Open, of course, being open source.
Amen.
So when you're tasting the strawberries in Mexico or the blueberries from Chile, you're actually tasting the environment in which it's grown. And what we're playing with here is how to optimize that environment so the plant produces exactly what you want. As the plant is growing and we're recording the data, we're essentially creating what we call a climate recipe. So, for example, we use basil, and we're growing lots of basil because it's a great model organism. Mm. And we're trying to optimize for flavor in basil.
So time.
Yeah, right? So we've eaten a lot of caprese salads. And when we used to harvest the basil, lots of pesto. Dr. Johnson over there is our flavor chemist.
The really cool thing about a lot of plants is that separate from like fruits and flowers, where their smells are designed to be attractive, most of the flavors in herbal plants or vegetables are designed and evolved by the plant to adapt to stress and to use in forms of like basically chemical warfare against insects and other plants and things like that.
We're trying to stress the plant out in order to get it to produce exactly what we want it to.
Before I was working here, I was the in-house scientist at Restaurant Noma in Copenhagen.
Oh my word, most famous restaurant in the world now. And the chef's name is?
René Redzepi.
Yeah.
He was my boss for
about three years.
Yeah.
You have met René Redzepi?
Many times. I've done CrossFit at René Redzepi's house.
How did you get here?
I, you know, have worked in and with restaurants for a long time. But
amazing.
Thinking even more about, like, what the restaurant was as a sort of node in the food system,
yeah.
And that a meal is not just like an isolated thing, but, you know, the culmination of many supply chains and culture and history coming together to make one plate.
Our guest, Caleb Harper, from a farm family in Kansas, presides over that Open Ag project inside the MIT Media Lab of all places, Caleb. The mission, you say, is to create the next billion farmers. Some will be in overalls on the land, some on their laptops or their iPhones, I presume, farming on the horizontal and the vertical in all sorts of man-made climates, using genetics, chemistry, flavor biology, as she said, to feed more and more billions of people on an overheating planet. The nutritionist, Dr. Walter Willett, is with us. The farm anthropologist, Julie Guthman, is standing by, and later Raj Patel and Jacques Pepin. But get us started, Caleb, for people on their way to the groaning family table at Thanksgiving. What's up in the food world as you see it, and what are you going to do about it?
Well, I think there's so many problems in the food world, and that's what we focus on, all the problems. You know, for 20 years we've been saying we're polluting the environment, there's not enough food, GMO is a curse, or GMO is a savior, and it goes on and on. But it's kind of a divisive landscape. So for our work, we thought, what could be a derivative problem? And as we looked at it, knowledge was a huge derivative problem, that there isn't a next generation coming up to do this work. You know, the average age of a farmer in the U.S. is 60. There's only 2% of the population involved. Things that, you know, FFA and 4-H are very, very small now. So we thought, well, how could we create, when people say in 2050 there will be this many billion people, we wondered, well, could a billion of them be farmers? And would it be a roboticist farmer, a data scientist farmer, you know, a flavor chemist farmer? So for that, you need tools. So that's, you know, where we took the work completely open source and said, we're going to develop tools for anti-disciplinary work. Not plant biology tools or plant biochemistry or robotics tools, but tools that can engage that person in a new activity. And I'd say the second part of that is that information piece. If you want to know more about this, over the last 30 years, we've siphoned off so much information into the private domain, and we've made it impossible to access. And in the process, we lost public trust. People said, I don't know what's in my food anymore. I don't know what a GMO is. I don't know what to think about it, but I don't trust you. So we're in this huge climate right now of distrust. The big five food companies are scrambling. How can they earn your trust back? That's opened up the door for startups that are talking about trust and better food. But we want to create some kind of a global commons where you can go to this global commons and whatever interest you have in food, whatever it is that you want to change, that you can find tools in that commons and you can find data that's useful for you to be able to make better decisions.
I've got to say, I hadn't thought of 4-H forever, but I was in the sheep club, the goat club, and the heifer club, and I wouldn't give it up for anything.
Yeah, well, if you go back now, they're just not there on the agriculture and plant side. You know, it's just a very small percentage because they can do other things. You know, I'm a prime example. My family came to the United States as immigrants. They were part of the land rush. They claimed a piece of land in Kansas. My great-great-grandmother was a mail order bride. I mean, that's where our family comes from, but we're not on the land anymore. You know, we left. My dad is in food, and he said, don't do food. You know, do technology. Do something relevant to your generation.
You still own the land?
Still own the land. Still farm the land, but with a partner farmer, a fifth-generation Kansan farmer. So we get to the enjoyment of going through it, but we're not there day to day, and there's a lot of us. You know, a lot of the youth that's left, a lot of families that have left for one reason or another, financial or to pursue other opportunities. And so I'm kind of that generation that's looking to come back, and we're coming back in very different ways.
You're a young man, and there are a lot of people like you, including my daughters, who are interested in permaculture, interested in farming, community gardening in the city, but they want to get back into the wilds sooner or later. Profile that body of a billion farmers you want to recruit or encourage or maybe fund. How's it going to happen? Who are they?
You don't even have to recruit them. They're there. Like my students at MIT come to me and they're not saying, I want to work for Google. I want to work for Facebook, which was maybe the last generation of students at MIT. They're saying, I want to change the world and I want to know, I want to be involved in changing the future of food, but I don't know where to start. I'm a mechanical engineer. And they think maybe mechanical engineering has nothing to do with food. And then I show them, you know, there's so many opportunities for a mechanical, electrical, computer science, data science. You know, right now is that moment of bio-digital convergence. And we talk a lot about that at the lab. You know, maybe the 70s, you know, digital convergence. Now it's bio-digital. Our tools are at the scale of biology, our digital tools. So it is a time when someone completely out of discipline can make a huge contribution in the field.
I shudder a little bit now, and we've been talking about it on the radio, when people talk about big data and AI and what computers can do, and you wonder, just what is it? You speak, I can get it at this level. When you know the intimate character of a plant, and we will reach the point when you don't send, you know, American wheat to India or some troubled zone of the world, you will send the recipe. Explain how that could work concretely and how we get there.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at what we do, what we're trying to understand is what we call the phenome or the phenomena that a set of genes encounter. People often call that climate. What it really is a collection of stress, abiotic or biotic stress, on an environment. And so we're trying to learn about that. If you said you were trying to study the phenome of plants 10 years ago, it would have been impossible. We didn't have the ability to collect that much data. Genetics information wasn't that readily available and cheap. The ability to store the data wasn't there, and certainly the availability to make advanced correlation like machine learning and AI. And so what we're trying to do now, it will be things grown in boxes, but it will also be things grown in boxes that teach us how to use the field better. So I have a project right now with Ferrero around hazelnut trees. Mm. We're growing hazelnut trees in boxes not because we think we will ever do that for production, but because there's just not a lot known about hazelnut trees. And so think of it like a decoder. We're trying to learn about that plant in all kinds of ways and say, you know, maybe if we were to add these microbes, we could reduce the amount of water in the field. The farmer can't afford to do all of these experiments. The farmer has to have a productive yield. They're hedging future markets. I mean, when I am with my ag friends, I every day realize how complex and interesting their lives are, but how much they have at risk. So it's all a risk game. So if we could take the farm and put it in a control environment, and then we could build a model, a mathematical model that we could run simulations on and say, you know, what if the climate changed? What if you added these microbes? What if? And it didn't cost the farmer any risk. I think that's one of our big projects we call the Climate Prospector. Could we look into these control environments for solutions for the field eventually? And I think that's kind of our golden right.
I want you to tease us with your vision of, it's not a vision, the code of the flavor of a Tuscan tomato reflecting soil, sunlight, cultivation, all manner of things. Your wonderful staff at the lab yesterday were talking about teasing the flavor of basil or of all sorts of other things. How much of this really centers on flavor?
A lot of it.
You know, mystery of it, but also
the flavor and the nutrition creation, you know, what that gene is expressing and offers to us. So what we'll do is things like, you know, basil has natural biodefenses when a predator is present. So it can actually chemically sense a bug's shell. And so we use bug shells, grind them up, put them in the plant environment, and then watch how the plant responds and records it. Turns out it concentrates essential oil. We want essential oil in basil plants because it's more fragrant. You can do more things with it. And so we're learning that language. And that language is so multifactorial because it's let's say it's 100 stresses and over time and in intensity and combination. So this is science that we don't understand yet, where we say, hey, pH with CO2 with this microbe, oh my, if you just did that, you would have gotten such a better production. Our agricultural stance has been dominate the landscape. Take a landscape, it's missing things, let's put all the things into it that it's missing, and then that's created us, of course, a lot of problems. But if we thought of the world as a collection of climates, and we said, we have a catalog at our disposal, we need to learn how to pair the right genetics with the right climate for new targets. Ag's target for the last 30 years was yield. The new targets are flavor, nutrition, and all of that.
Got to ask before the break, in your lab, people were talking about tweaking plants to grow off-world. Are you part of this larger project to settle Mars?
Yeah, we're working with, well, not Mars, but we're working with NASA for deep space right now. And it's all about, we're not coming back for a pizza once we get there.
And we're going to send the plants ahead. Coming up, Walter Willett grew up on a dairy farm in Michigan on his way to becoming a doctor and ringleader in the Harvard Public Health Guide titled Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy. He says we're way off the track to survival of our species. This is Open Source. The potluck food hour, when a nutritionist and a computer geek walk into a radio studio in the week before Thanksgiving. Same week, an anthropologist in the California strawberry fields made a story out of one beautiful berry that doesn't always taste like itself nowadays. Julie Guthman writes and teaches the whole food story, farm to table, past to present, at the University of California. She's wintering out in Cambridge, writing about strawberries.
Strawberries are probably the most beleaguered crop in California right now, except for possibly almonds. But strawberries have been condemned both because of labor practices. This is an ongoing issue, as well as the high chemical load applied to strawberries. It's the most chemical intensive crop of anything else grown in a state. And the chemicals that are of most interest and have really motivated my research are soil fumigants. Soil fumigants are used to control soil pathogens, and they're highly toxic. They've been around for a very long time. One of the ones they use is chlorpicrin, which was a wartime tear gas. The problem is the entire kind of strawberry production system has been built around these chemicals.
Will commercial strawberries ever taste like strawberries again?
Taste has been considered, but strawberry breeding has mainly been built around ensuring the longevity of the season and having more productive varieties. I mean, yeah, I've talked to breeders say they're looking for a tasty berry, but the imperatives are elsewhere. The growers want high yield. The shippers want durability so they can be shipped back east and stay in the stores for a few weeks. And now there's a big imperative for pathogen resistance. So taste doesn't get a lot of attention, and nor does nutrition. I should just say that California grows 88% of the strawberries sold in the United States. Now, the labor question is a very interesting issue because, I mean, the whole system of harvest labor in California has been based on a system of producing excess. The border policy and immigration policy has for a long time really served the strawberry industry by creating a very vulnerable labor force. If you have people that are don't want to pay the costs and really are risking their lives, most literally, to cross the border, then they're not going to complain if there's wage theft or sexual assault on the job, which is routine, or pesticide use violations around workers. I mean, there's particular measures you're supposed to take around workers that are they're easy to violate if people aren't going to complain. So that's all served the industry well, but it's still a highly militarized border. And when the economy is booming elsewhere, workers don't stay around strawberries. It's kind of an entry-level position. And so the strawberry industry is actually seeing a big labor shortage.
Does this tell the larger story of where we're at with our food?
I think so. I mean, strawberries in that way is a small story, but it's a very California story because it's a story of pesticides and labor that have been like the mainstays of the otherwise highly nutritious fresh fruits and vegetables that California has been known for 100 years.
Thank you, Julie Guthman from the UC Santa Cruz and Harvard's Radcliffe Institute. Dr. Walter Willett is the great generalist at our table, public health researcher, nutritionist, author of the best-selling Eat, Drink, and Be Healthy. Take us, please, Dr. Willett, from strawberries to your sense of the big picture. And may I ask you first, are you the guy that got trans fats out of French fries?
Yes, that was about 30 years of our work, and it's happened. And we see heart disease rates actually going down, it looks like, in part because of that.
Good for you. Now, the big picture, where are we headed?
Yes, I think Julie describes, as she says, just one symptom of a much bigger picture. For the last almost 40 years, we and our research group at Harvard have been tracking the diets of several hundred thousand people and looking at what happens to them in the long run in terms of cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, et cetera. And the big picture that's emerged is that we would be much better off if we were eating a more plant-based diet, a healthy plant-based diet, because, you know, donuts and Coke are plant-based too, but that's not what we're talking about. But we have a quite good idea of a healthy dietary pattern. But the American public and the rest of the world falls very far short in terms of achieving a healthy diet. But what's become very clear in the last few years to us, and it's been clear to other people for a longer time, is that our whole food system has gone badly off track. It's not only producing food that's making us unhealthy, but it's destroying the system that we need to produce food at the same time. I think, to me, one of the big picture views is just flying over the Midwest, where I grew up, and you see that the vast majority of cultivated land is corn and soy. And that's what our family farm in Michigan looks like, too. It's vast fields of corn merged with the next farm and the next farm and the next farm. And then we look at the data about what's actually used with all that corn. And when we in the United States, we use about a third of it to convert to ethanol to drive cars. That's not necessary. If we just had cars that were a little smaller, we drove them a little bit less and walked, rode our bike, took public transportation, we'd be healthier. We don't really need to convert corn to ethanol. 45% is fed to animals that make us sick, give us diabetes, cardiovascular disease when we eat all that red meat. And About 15% is converted to high fructose corn syrup and other manufactured products that's also making us sick. And only 10% is actually eaten by humans. So, you know, how could we have created a system that's so bad? This huge monoculture is destroying our agricultural land, our environment. And at the same time, it's making us sick.
You know, it's fascinating. People don't want to hear that the end is near. But I believe you intuitively that we've entered a new phase. We didn't. The end of the fish population is in sight, and we're still fishing it. Dan Barber, the celebrity chef in New York, made a related point that we've never lived this way as a sort of last predator going for the last use of a field till it's exhausted without thinking of sustaining it. What's wrong here?
There are multiple problems here, and we and some other colleagues and I have been looking at this big picture of how are we going to feed 50 billion, by 2050, almost 10 billion people, a diet that's both healthy and sustainable. So our grandchildren, who will be alive in 2100, will be able to experience the environment and be able to have a good food supply. And it's clear that we are far off track in reaching that goal. There are several things that need to happen if we're going to do it. One is that we do need to make a major shift in our diets, both for our individual health and for the long-term health of the planet and the very basis of our food supply. We need to move toward much more toward a plant-based diet. It doesn't have to mean that everyone will be a vegan. There's room for some animal products, but it's a small part of
I can
diet.
Imagine it. Let me say, I would miss the lamb chops, but I can imagine. I think West Africa, fufu. I lived for weeks on fufu, which is basically cassava flour and other grains. Incredibly nutritious, simple, tasty. The chefs in my family say we could live on lentils, you know, and we could make it incredibly tasty too. Why not?
Well, actually, living on fufu is not such a great thing. It's a huge carbohydrate load, and that's a very imbalanced diet. It needs to have definitely some lentils, some nuts, some fruits and vegetables. Varied in many different ways. But the point is, your basic point, though, is right. If we move toward a much healthier vegetarian diet, again, not completely vegetarian, that's not necessary, that would go a long way. But as we look at it, that's not going to be sufficient, even if the whole world went that way.
What do you make of Caleb's promise of numbers, data, all that information?
It's clear that we need to look at every step in the whole food system quantitatively, analytically, to produce food in the smartest, most efficient way. And it does need to be good tasting food if we want people to shift toward this healthy plant-based diet. It definitely has to be tasty. In fact, when we look at the picture, the biggest challenger is people, actually, is in changing behavior.
I want to hear from you, Dr. Willett, the forward vision that's going to make it interesting, delicious, fun, sociable, good family stuff. What is the name of a plausible movement after the locavore, you know, tide seems to be going out? Could it be permaculture? Could it be, I don't know, some sort of real serious back to the land campaign?
We'll have to give that some very careful thought because it's a marketing issue. And we do see that there's no one single solution to this problem. We have to shift our diets in a big way. We have to cut down on waste in a major way. We have to find ways, better ways to produce our food, more efficient ways to use the resources we have. One very important element has to be that the whole agricultural system, it does need to be converted to clean energy. That's at the core of a lot of problems. We can't really, essentially, we're turning fossil fuel into food to a large extent in our present agricultural system. We have to get away from that.
I want to go back to Caleb Harper and the Open Ag Project at MIT. Not least, could you, with all that, not only data, but manipulative power, could you rebreed the strawberry? To get rid of the packaging, get rid of the long-lasting, the infinitely long season. Could you remake the berries of old?
Well,
Well, I think we're seeing some amazing things happening in that space, and I would put it all under the umbrella of democratizing technology that's been concentrated in the hands of the few that makes decisions for the many. And what I mean by that is we've had one GMO of all time for flavor, and it wasn't even for flavor. It was called the Flavor Saver Tomato. It was for shelf life. We've had one GMO of all time for nutrition. It's called Golden Rice, and it's not that old. So now you're seeing the democratization of things like CRISPR-Cas9 and its ability to do in-genome editing. Now, that freaks everybody out because they don't really know what's happening. Because
you're right at the edge, then, of our anxiety.
But can you
stuff.
Imagine, you know, they're using that technology to rid the world of malaria, to rid the world of Lyme disease, hopefully. These are some of the things that they're aiming at. What if we use the same technology to be editing for, and we've been editing since 10,000 BC. Don't fool yourself. We've been training food to do what we wanted it to do for a very long time. Could we use some of these new tools to aim towards nutrition? Could we aim towards sustainability? And could we aim towards flavor? And I believe that we can.
We were joking about open source. Open source in the way you're using it to bring the periphery into the conversation at the center. And nobody owns these ideas, and everybody can apply them. How does that work in practice? That people say, wait a sec, I found something in my green peppers or whatever.
So what it looks like in practice is we're trying to create what we call a civic data common, and a civic actually hardware common. So to make it simple, we use licenses that were developed in the 70s, general public license. This was for liberating software from hardware, getting more people developing hardware. You know, it was started by folks over at MIT that are still hanging around. We use Creative Commons, which is not usually meant for hardware, but that's how we use it.
Know it well, sure.
Yep. So we use Creative Commons on all our hardware, and we're working on a Mozilla data science license so that the data can be pooled, shared, and aggregated. So when I think about what I hope I leave behind, you know, is it changing the food system? Maybe, but it's definitely creating more minds with more access to information and tools so that we can have very diverse perspectives offering solutions for the future of food that go beyond anecdote.
Explain. Be particular.
So I think you have a lot of people that have opinions and ideas about food, but they really don't have the access to a platform and a technology to show that that might be scalable. You know, you have this conversation going on that has small shareholder farmers the way to go, locavores the way to go, but it doesn't take into account or really address the next 21 million person cities in India. So we've got a gulf between what we like to accept in our head as what could feed the world as this small organic farm, and it feels comfortable and it feels like you can wrap your head around it. But we can't go back to a feudal system or a subsistence way of farming to feed these 9, 10 billion people that we're talking about. We have to find something in the middle. So to create that something in the middle, I think you need more diverse thinkers. How did we get corn everywhere? Because there was only a few people and we aggregated all of the technology and the land. But could the corn belt actually be a collection of 3,000 microclimates? And could we have enough information that we could pair the best, you know, tomato in this very specific place because it would express a lycopene that our bodies are hungry for that would be good for us. You have a startup now in the U.S. that has more in-field data in the last 5 years than the USDA has digitized in its entire history. We are really going forward to this fast.
Dr. Willett, he mentioned the USDA. What is the prospect in this compromised Congress and federal regulation of making a difference from Washington?
Pretty dismal as far as I can see at this point in time. If you don't believe in climate change, what science are you going to believe in? But there's so much else that we can be doing locally at states and at our educational and research institutions. And what Caleb is talking about in some ways is not new, that I went to a cow college, Michigan State University. And in fact, my father was a research scientist, worked on essentially improving the genetics of cows, and now they are producing about 5 times more milk per cow than they were in 1950. And it was thought that, I think, nutritionists believed we needed more milk at that time. And that's where most of our resources went, into a few animal foods and a few commodity crops. But now we realize the comment about hazelnuts, because our data are showing that, in fact, hazelnuts in general are really healthy, and it would be tremendous, and we should be producing several fold more hazelnuts globally than we, not just hazelnuts, but other nuts globally than we are now. And we have many more tools, as Caleb describes, to do what we had to do by trial and error. It was done scientifically, though empirically, careful experiments throughout the history of agriculture. But I think what's changed is the tools are much more powerful, and we need to move faster than
and
we
did. The interests, let's face it, are entrenched, including petroleum in the food world, not to mention the farmers and all those interests. But I want to locate the ferment, including in those state universities. I'm old enough to remember when UMass was called Mass Aggie back in the day, but those were interesting laboratories. How do you get yeast out of that?
That is a challenge, and there is a connection with Washington because that was done with a lot of federal funding. I think we're probably going to, hopefully the present funding status in Washington will not go on forever. We really do need to shift research into areas that are critical for human health and for planetary health. In the meantime, states, I hope, will pick up some of that.
What are the investment implications here, Caleb? I mean, who's going to see an opportunity here?
Well, I think that's a great point, because we're talking about who's really going to move the dial. And if you look at who's moving the dial right now, you know, MIT was a land-grant university, right? Mm. Just think about that. And then it's not now, but you know what's back on the Capitol campaign? Food. Is it because Washington put it there? No. It's because of the giant interest in it. And if you look at all of the startups and the vibrant ecosystem that's being funded out of the big five food companies, they're raising hundreds and millions of dollars to change and make different food deliveries and different offerings in agriculture and so on. So I don't think it's going to be driven by Washington. But, you know, one crazy idea, you know, when I talk with pension funds and I say, I don't even know why I'm in this room. Why are you talking to me? I have nothing to do with pension funds. They say, well, you know, agriculture is the bedrock of a pension fund. We just know that the price of the land is always going to go up. We don't invest in farming, but we invest in the land. Could you change that? I said, well, you know, if we're more successful with using things like indoor farms or using land more efficiently, then yes, we could start needing less land to produce more good food, which would give the chance for the land to rewild, which would give the chance for, you know, a lot of great things to happen.
A cult investor, very famous and successful man we know in Boston, says the best imaginable investment for young people is in forestry and farmland. It's that you can't invent it again, and it's going to be more important than ever. Coming up, Raj Patel coined that phrase, stuffed and starved, to cover more than 2 billion people, about a third of all humanity, who are hungry at one end of the spectrum or ill-fed and overweight at the other. The food problem, he's saying again, is money. This is Open Source. Raj Patel's attention-getting new book on food, co-written with the environmental thinker Jason Moore, is titled A History of the World in 7 Cheap Things. It makes the argument that at the center of the global and local food problem is this impulse to make it cheaper than cheap and to undermine the value of everything that goes into it. First, nature, then money itself, capital, labor and the care of workers, energy, the value of human life itself, and the food that is there to sustain us. Raj Patel boiled it down with me this week in the story of one edible commodity, the chicken McNugget.
The chicken McNugget is the sort of signature trace, because there are now 12 billion chickens alive, but not for long. Every year, there are 50 billion chickens born and killed on Earth.
Wow.
So what we're leaving behind is a legacy of trillions of chicken bones. And the reason that the chicken has become the world's most popular bird is because it has been taken from the jungles of Asia. Its genetics messed with. Workers have been exploited to be able to make the chicken cheap. When those workers' bodies are broken, they're thrown out to the communities to be taken care of. The feed that goes into the U.S. chicken is subsidized to the tune of $1.25 billion a year. And you need cheap fossil fuels to oil that system. You need cheap money to be able to give you a loan for your local KFC, which is eligible for a cheap loan under the terms of the Small Business Administration. And you need disposable workers, cheap lives all the way along the line. And so this chicken isn't something that all human civilizations have taken and cast into the soil. The reason that we will have trillions of chicken bones, this is a symptom of capitalism, not of humans being humans. There's something very weird about our civilization that will leave this particular trace in the fossil record.
That was Raj Patel at the University of Texas. I put it to you first, Caleb Harper, and then both of you. Is it plausible that the global food system is one merciless race to the bottom? Or another way to say it, that the only escape starts with revaluing upward all the elements that go into our diet?
I think the race starts by changing the target of the race, changing the finish line. You know, the finish line was more cheap food. That's all people really wanted and asked for, and we didn't think we were going to be able to feed everyone in the 70s. So that was – everything was geared towards more cheap food. But now you have take the chicken McNugget. What's the latest thing in that? McDonald's is telling you exactly what's in it, that it doesn't have antibiotics, and trying to tell you the story of the chicken. Why do they do that? Because people want to know, where did it come from? What's in it? How good is the environment, you know, that's left behind? And so you're changing the target in the mind of the consumer that says, I value those things. And they've definitely shown up with their dollars, with everything else. And so I think you're seeing that shift, and that's the race upwards. And it's new targets for the food system, and it's more people that can think about it. Because I sit here and I'm tired of hearing the doom and gloom story. It doesn't do anything to motivate a young generation. It's divisive.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's totally divisive. It creates camps. People argue with each other that could have been friends. And so it's like, okay, how do we create a positive story? And then how do we give some people new tools so that they can engage with it from a 21st century lens?
Raj Patel would also say we're not paying enough attention to poor people or to the problem of patriarchy and the solution in empowerment of women, in farming, as in educated farming. Speak to that, Balder, if you will.
Well, I think he's quite right. We have been tracking diet quality in the United States since 2000. And the good news is, on average, our diets are improving from a health standpoint. We are eating more whole grains, a bit more fruits, a bit more vegetables. Soda consumption has come down by about 25%. So there are many things moving in the right direction. Trans fat has been almost eliminated. But when we stratify by income and education, almost all of that improvement has been in the upper income, upper education group. And if we look at low income, low education groups, their diets are not improving. So the gap's rapidly increasing. So this is a symptom of a lot of other basic problems in society that I think Raj did talk about. And that goes beyond just agricultural systems. It goes to living wages, issues of gender equity, as you mentioned. Those are really important issues, and they directly connect what we eat with our health and well-being in the long run. So it's like everything. All the parts are connected.
The race to the bottom warning we've heard before. There was a wonderful woman politician, foodist in India, Vandana Shiva. You probably know her, Walter. But she was on the warpath years ago about the massive export of corn oil to the third world, specifically India, where ancient traditions of Indian oil were being crushed by the fact that nobody can compete with the subsidized American price. How's to block that kind of, you know, devastation of local tradition, local identity, probably better food too?
Yes, there are big issues there. Corn oil is just one example of that. In Mexico, which basically their traditional diet is based on corn, the majority of that corn now is produced in the United States, and local farmers in Mexico can't compete. And a lot of that is the price in this country is often artificially low because for many reasons, we've put lots of resources into, as was mentioned, minimizing the price and essentially subsidizing indirectly the price of oil and energy, which doesn't internalize the environmental costs. So you have this system that's essentially using destruction of our own environment to subsidize cheap oils.
Who's to stop that, Walter?
Go beyond my expertise in there. But it is a deep political problem. It gets into international trade protectionism and on one side, subsidies on the other. And we clearly need to look at this. It's very fundamental to functions of society.
On the developing
Caleb,
world, yeah,
please.
I have to jump in because it's been such an interesting journey for me. You know, I got the pleasure of speaking with Kofi Annan about African subcontinent farming, and he said, "Well, what can you do that's gonna help Africa?" And I said, "I have no idea. The technology's young. It's gonna break. It's expensive." Hmm. And he shared something with me that was pretty profound. He said, "You know, everybody comes over to the developing world and tries to increase us incrementally in percentages to be more like a U.S. farming system." And he's like, "I don't want that. I want to leapfrog that. We have a huge opportunity ahead of us with our population booms, with rising incomes." And he was like, "And by the way, half of our population under 18, 80% don't want to be farmers. They've seen the life of their grandparents and their parents, and they're moving to the cities. You look at a city like Lagos, African megacities on the rise everywhere. So while we're paying attention to the small shareholder farmer and things like Millennium Development Goals, which are important, we need to also realize that the developing world has a huge chance to not make the same mistakes that we do." And one quick story I can share, we brought some food computers to a refugee camp in Amman, and we thought they'd grow things that they might want in Jordan, that a Syrian refugee camp, and we thought they'd grow things that they might want to eat because that's what we thought they should do. I came back and I found out that the farmer that took control of them happened to be a PhD in St. John's wort. He decided to grow St. John's wort because it's a depression alleviant. And then the camp was rife with depression. And so just by giving new tools, new capabilities to someone with a brilliant brain in their local context, they can devise solutions that we just can't conceive of because that's not our culture and not our place.
The rule is that if you really want to hear about trends and fashion and futures and what's actually happening in the marketplace, talk to a chef. Carolyn Johnson is on the line. She's the chef at Moon Cusser Fish House in Boston. Carolyn, we're trying to imagine the future. What do you see in what's hot, what's not, what's unavailable, what's good, what's tasty, what sells?
Well, this seems like quite a segue to go from the refugee camps to my restaurant. But since we're doing the fancy stuff up here. But as far as trends, I think there's been this great movement. I've been doing this for 20 years in Boston and been working in farm-to-table restaurants the whole time. And now that's become almost passe. It's such a part of what everyone's doing now, which I think is really amazing. And I think that vegetable-forward cooking is a big piece of that, that we're seeing a lot around the restaurants these days, so that's exciting.
What do you learn from the fate of fish in general? I mean, going back to the whale, but the shortage of fish today, the end of a great fishing town like Gloucester or the industry in it. What can you tell from, including our kind of moral recklessness about this kind of the prospect ahead, Carolyn?
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely seafood sourcing is incredibly challenging at this point because the oceans are so depleted of the wild species and trying to navigate, where do we draw the lines? I mean, I think still, for myself, seeking out the, the wild species are still the most delicious that are on the market. So trying to figure out how to do that responsibly and then figure out as well how to mix in responsibly farmed seafood as well.
I was going to say, Caleb, do you know how to make a tasty farm fish?
That is something, honestly, aquaponics I've kind of avoided for a couple of reasons because it's so incredibly difficult. You have a life inside of water that's alive. You have that's feeding a plant that's alive. That's feeding a human that's alive. You're conflating a lot of ecosystems that can be quite dangerous next to each other. And so, it also would require animal testing in a lab, which I don't want to go for. But I think it is, I'm seeing startups. There's a startup called Finless Foods that's doing cell culture to come up with, cellular agriculture or meat that's not made from an animal that was alive. And so I don't know. This is far in the future, but it's happening now. I don't know exactly where that's going to end up, but you're seeing chicken, you're seeing beef, you're seeing pork and fish now being cultured in things, like a lab.
Do you believe it, Carolyn?
Oh, I believe it. It's definitely somewhat frightening for someone who likes to, really appreciates curated foods and things that the farmers I work with bring me and the fishermen. And it's hard for me to make that mental leap into that kind of extreme of cultured, like petri dish dinner.
Walter Willett, what are you thinking?
Well, I think this is a very good example. You can take almost any particular food or food group, and you come to this same sort of set of challenges that, for example, fish we see as being very healthy. It contains essential fatty acids, and many people are short on those. Part of it is really conserving the natural catch, and some places in the world are doing that pretty well. Iceland, actually Alaska, is doing it quite well. And so there is some a sustainable harvest there if we do it right, but it's limited. We can't just harvest as much as we want to. If we limit that, care for it. And then the aquaculture area is an area where we should be putting research efforts. It can be done badly, and we have some examples where it can be done quite well. So, and the answers will vary from one place to another. So it's an issue of research investment to a large extent.
Back to the Dan Barber line that we are ready to pillage the soil of its nutrients and the sea of those fish, the same way we mine, as if it were, you know, iron to be mined or oil to be pumped, until we turn to fracking. He says we got to change our thinking about what is essentially doomsday farming.
I think, you know, one of the things I find most fascinating now is take our water in the lab, for example. We recently cultured and sequenced it just to figure out what was alive. I found out that was the first time that in an aquaculture setup, and aquaculture can be just, you know, plants and water, there was the first time that there'd ever been a cultured microbiome of the root system in that kind of environment. And you're seeing that level of technology applied in the field now too. So when people say, oh, the terroir, we've got to unpack that so that we can understand it. The terroir, the microbes, the minerals, the carbon, the water. You know, we need to not stop at saying good soil is good soil, but why is good soil good soil? Why is bad soil bad soil? And can we repopulate with microbes again? Can we rebuild that soil health? You know, there's interesting companies enrobing seeds now with microbes. So they're planting microbes to recreate that soil microbiome that gives you a much better plant.
Do you want to critique my new fantasy, the permaculture notion that even on a tiny piece of land, you can mix the uses, the animals, the crops, in such a way as to produce, as the book says, wonderful abundance? Walter, do you believe it?
I think we can do a lot better than we certainly have done in our monoculture food system. But we need to look at that very carefully, all the inputs and outputs of energy. The challenges of, again, feeding close to 10 billion people are going to be extreme, and there's no simple answer. So that's something that needs to be looked at very carefully. I would like to loop back to the role of chefs in this and food services.
Carolyn Johnson's of the world. Thank you.
Exactly. And your daughter. Because this isn't going to happen unless the foods that come out of this system and are healthy and sustainably produced are flavorful and attractive and aspirational. And making the foods into that kind of aspiration will require creativity on the food service and chef
world. Well, and if you look at some of the chefs, they're starting to serve bycatch. You know, and call it bycatch and say, this is the stuff that we didn't mean to catch, but we're going to make something amazing out of it.
We absolutely need that creativity.
It's really nice, actually, to really force your creativity to figure out how to make those, you know, the bycatch, whether it's scup or ocean perch or Boston mackerel or all these things that are sort of less appealing fish or not name-recognized fish, and figure out how to get your customers to be coming back for more.
The last word before Thanksgiving is from the legendary French chef Jacques Pepin. He broke into the big time cooking for General Charles de Gaulle in the 1950s. Jacqueline Kennedy asked him to be the White House chef. He partnered with Julia Child on television, and he is still teaching his art at Boston University. Anthony Bourdain said wonderfully, if Jacques Pepin shows you how to make an omelet, the matter is pretty much settled. That is God talking. He spoke to us about holiday tables coming up with his family in Connecticut.
The food is the common denominator. I mean, in the kitchen, the taste and all that, at least there is no political or racial or religious or any type of connotation in the food. When you put that roast on the table and everyone dig into it, it's pure enjoyment for everybody. share a glass of wine and eat and talk about one thing or another. Yeah, it's important.
Jacques Pepin, maybe it's the accent, but you remind me of Proust writing about Françoise, the family cook.
Yes.
She would serve Sunday dinner. As the labor of fields and orchards, the harvest of the tides, the luck of the markets, the kindness of neighbors, and her own genius might provide. That's France a long time ago, but what can we learn in the States today, 100 years later?
What Proust called the affective memory, I mean the memory of the senses, are much more important for a cook than the memory of the brain. I mean, if you tell me where were you, like before in 1957, yeah, my brain worked for a minute or so, and I will tell you where I was. But when I woke with my granddaughter and my dog in the wood, and I smelled mushroom, all of a sudden I'm 11 years old mushrooming with my father and my brother. So those affective memory, you know, whether it's the smell, the touch, the eyesight, hearing, are very, very immediate and very, very powerful. And still for us, they are important. That's why I like to go to the market. I like to tell my granddaughter, pick me up some pear there. Make sure they are ripe. Smell them. Look at them. So, you know, you touch the food. You smell the food. You talk about it. You go to the garden. I tell her, get me some tarragon. No, no, this is chive. No, tarragon is there. You know, this is oregano. So she was like that since she was 2-3 years old. My daughter also. So it becomes something which is very natural, part of the way we do, all right, take your mushrooming in the wood or picking up some little fish along the sea or, you know, thing like that. Kind of visceral memory, you know, when you come back from school and sit in the kitchen and hear mother and your father talking and hear the noise of the equipment and smell of that kitchen and the taste kind of stay with you the rest of your life, you know. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose.
Thank you, Jacques Pepin.
Bon appétit and à bientôt.
And thank you, Caleb Harper, Walter Willett, Carolyn Johnson, and Julie Guthman. If you're anywhere around Boston on the Monday after Thanksgiving, please join me and the cabaret singer and heartthrob, Amanda Palmer. She and I will be talking about songs and life, and maybe she'll sing her song about me. For tickets, go to radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne, with help from Hannah Degner, Honor Lydon, and Dan Barber. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive chef. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.